This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the Anthropology channel of the New Books Network. I'm Yadong Li, a host of New Books in Anthropology and a PhD student in Anthropology at Tulane University. Multi-species engagement is receiving more and more intellectual attention in the humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences. Particularly in anthropology, the trend towards research about multi-species ethnography or post-humanism is creating new opportunities to reflect on the biological social divisions and learning from more than human words to go beyond anthropocentrism. There are some helpful sites for anthropologists to capture and examine encounters of human and non-human beings. The new book we'll discuss today centers its sites on a farm in central Hokkaido, focusing on the operation of otherness in multi-species interactions. I'm very pleased to chat with the new book's author, Professor Paul Hansen. So, Paul, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. It's our pleasure to have you. The new book today is Hokkaido Diary Farm, Cosmopolitics of Otherness and Security on the Frontiers of Japan, published by the State University of New York Press in February 2024. So it's a brand new book. So the author, Paul Hansen, is professor in the Department of International Resource Sciences at Akita University in Japan. He has conducted research in Japan, Canada, and Jamaica. In his research, he focuses on the issues of identity, ethics, embodiment, post-humanism, and animal-human-technology relationships. So, Paul, I think Hokkaido Diary Farm, just like most ethnographic works, is a highly personalized work. So I think it's highly related to your own experience and own labor. So I think it might be helpful for our audience to know more about you. Could you please give a self-introduction to our audience, particularly about where you originally from and what brought you to Japan and to central Hokkaido?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm originally from Alberta, Canada, and I grew up during the weekdays basically in the city of Calgary, which is about 1.4 million people now, is about 400,000 people when I was growing up, so kind of a boom prairie city. And then the weekends I spent my time in Rocky Mountain House, Alberta, which is now a town of about 10,000 people, on a cattle farm. Well, former cattle farm, it's now a tree farm. And my coming to Japan was a fluke, really, because a lot of people are really passionate to come to Japan. You know, they're really focused on anime or manga or martial arts, or they're interested in those kind of things. And I really wasn't. I was originally interested in Vietnam, and specifically in Vietnamese religion and migrant community building outside of Vietnam, in London and Calgary specifically. But there's a Woody Allen quote that says, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. So even though I tried to focus on Vietnam, I had an MA advisor focused on Japanese Buddhism. And then, so that's what I did. and then focused a PhD advisor who focused on identity in Japan. So that's what I did. And I kind of half-heartedly started doing field work in Hiroshima on Brazilian factory workers. And then just by a chance encounter, I went to my friend owned a snack bar there. And I met two people who were looking at a picture book, and it looked like it was from Alberta or BC, somewhere in Canada. And I asked if they had visited there, and they said, no, actually, it's Hokkaido, Japan. And I said, what is that? And I became really intrigued by this sort of colonial settler history of Hokkaido. Ended up working on an industrial farm there for research for a year. And I remain in love with that area of Japan. I just came back from there last week, actually. So I'm fresh back from field work.
Great, great. Just like the book, yeah, it's just fresh, brand new. And also, I think it's a fascinating story. And talking about the book, so Hokkaido Diary Form is in the Asian Studies series of SUNY Press, but definitely I can see what you hope to discuss in the book goes beyond Japan and the East Asian context. Mm. But in turn, I think your ethnographic discussion cannot also be separated from the Japanese history, especially the Japanese diary industry and the local history of Hokkaido as a frontier, as a borderland of Japanese modernity. So I think it's fair to say it's a book about Japan, of Hokkaido, but going beyond Hokkaido and Japan. I'm curious about, as the author, what do you think this book is about?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's quite sprawling, as you know. It covers a lot of space, a lot more space than a typical ethnography, maybe. But at its core is a move from a macro history of Hokkaido, mainly central Hokkaido, to an ethnography largely informed by post-human or cosmopolitan theories of a single central Hokkaido farm and its inhabitants, both two and four-legged. In essence, it's about how capital otherness, for example, stereotypical generalizations of group formation or assumptions about people or species break down when one has individual encounters or experiences, or what I frame as each otherness or individuated otherness that entail a certain risk to security broadly defined from national to ontological, over frontiers, again, broadly defined from ideological to the bounds of living bodies. And in that way, it questions many assumptions about reductive and unified Japanese identity. Well, I hope it also offers an evocative ethnography of an industrializing dairy farm and the many tensions that stem from industrialization, rapid industrialization. We're talking about over, a generation, basically.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, this book, after I read it, I think it's a very hardcore and old school kind of ethnography, but discussing very interesting topic and a very recent, very heated topic in anthropology, because you start from the history of Japanese modernity, the history of Hokkaido, and all this background, and then you went to the more detailed information, the structure and the work, all these things about this diary form. So it's really a comprehensive work about a Hokkaido diary form, and I really like one. So I think it's time to dive into your field work and field site. So as the title shows, this book is grounded in ethnographic research on a farm in central Hokkaido. So in the introduction, you spend a great amount of ink describing your experience of first arriving in central Hokkaido. I think it's impossible to recount the whole experience in an interview, but may I invite you to briefly recall what the experience was like when you first arrived at your field site in Tokachi, Hokkaido?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is just that classic setting of the scene, the narrator of the ethnography washing up on the beach, so to speak. But I guess for me, arriving in Tokachi felt a bit like a kind of ironic twist. I mean, even a bit sort of surreal, because I was doing, here I am doing research in Japan, a country that's tirelessly exoticized as capital O other, the classic counterpoint here to the West, a la Ruth Benedict and so on. And many of my cohort were researching urban relationships or subcultural groups like cosplay groups, things that seem to really fit within that idea of a unique or quirky Japan. But what I faced in Tokachi and in Gensan, which is the pseudonym I gave the town, was in many ways felt to me like arriving back in rural Alberta. And I presume would feel the same way to other places with a similar 19th or 20th century colonial colonial settler history like Australia or the North American West, and I presume parts of South America. So it was kind of odd in that way. It didn't feel so distant. And what's common or shared in these sorts of colonial spaces outweighs, at least to me, the differences, whether positive or negative, right? So you find similar patterns of settlement, similar industries, similar or periphery relations, a similar story of indigenous peoples, plants, and animals subdued to make way for settlers alongside new animals, and this narrative of the frontier of open space, and specifically in the case of Hokkaido, of kaitaku or reclamation, right? This idea of reclaiming a kind of abandoned or open space. So that's kind of the good and the bad and the ugly of that. I guess the good part for me was to get away from metropoles. I didn't really want to focus research in a major urban center. And I felt really comfortable being around these very independent, kind of resilient frontiers type kind of people. I soon felt pretty at home because the town wasn't that dissimilar from the Alberta prairies where I grew up, or at least that's the way I perceived it. The dairy farm itself was a bit of a shock because I'd spent, most of my life up to that point around free-range dairy cattle, beef cattle. They're just kind of out there in the distance in the field in the summer. In the winter, you might have to water or feed them, but nothing really prepared me for the factory-like regimen, the sort of full body and affect-saturated daily grind, and the many conflicts that are on an industrializing dairy farm. That's grueling for the human workers, not to mention for the cows who are there.
Excellent. I think our audience will have basically a picture about your field site now. And you mentioned the frontier in your answer quite a few times, and talking about Hokkaido, you also use the term frontier in the book to describe this region. So this island of Hokkaido is home to numerous physical and ideological frontiers. In the book, you also state that this term is carefully chosen. So why do you choose this term, and what do you mean by frontier?
I'm really grateful for this question, Yadong, because it's caused me a lot of grief in the past, people trying to understand what exactly I mean by the frontier. I say it's carefully chosen because I want to make it clear that I'm aware of its 20th and 19th century baggage. Some people really railed against me using the term early on, like I was somehow invoking it as a kind of historical amnesia, or it indicated my kind of neoliberal tendencies or something. In fact, it's exactly the opposite, right? Embracing that very ideological deployment of the term frontier is central to how Hokkaido was reimagined from Ezogashima, that is in Japanese a wild or barbarian island, to Hokkaido, which is presently called, which means North Sea Route or North Sea Circuit. So in short, the act of securing this location firmly within the bounds of the Imperial Japanese state in the 1860s. In sum, using the frontier as an organizing theme is kind of underscores this indisputable claim to an imperial and geopolitical past. The Meiji government saw this land open for the taking, with its inhabitants othered and subdued. And I think most people are aware of this history when thinking about the Americas or Australia. But I think few think about Hokkaido as the kind of Japanese answer, or at least part of it anyway, to a global moment of empire making and frontier imagining. So using the term frontier in this historical and ideological sense is essential to better understand contemporary relations in the area, but it also enables clear comparisons with other sort of frontier regions, right? It underscores a continuity and a commonality that's sometimes under-investigated. So why not, in other words, compare Hokkaido with Alaska, Alberta, or the Australian outback? So that's the kind of macro usage. On the micro level, I use the term frontier because I thought it would describe relations between quite different agents, both human and non-human. So for example, I describe individuals as locals, low-siders, or long-term residents and outsiders, or people who come and might opt to stay, maybe becoming low-siders in the future, and then no-siders, who would be people like foreign workers, right? And these are somewhat sort of malleable cultural social frontiers that separate these groups, right? And I'm not sure how far we want to go into this, but there's also the non-human human breaching of bodily frontiers, for example, during the act of artificial insemination, or pathogens that pass between species, for example. So I guess all in all, frontiers to me was just a very compelling metaphor and theme in connecting and thinking through these sorts of macro to micro relationships. I mean, at least I hope you saw it that way. I hope readers see it that way. I don't know if they will.
Yeah, exactly. I can totally see it, and definitely, I think Frontier is a multi-skiller and multi-dimensional analytic lens in your book. And also, I think your book reminds us that modernity and also, modernity always needs to create its frontier to sustain its expansion. And this frontier could mean a regional frontier, like you mentioned, about Alaska, about Hokkaido, about all the so-called underdeveloped area, but it also include the non-human, human, non-human frontier, also in your book about the Hokkaido Dairy Farm.
Sure,
And
and history and the future as a frontier as well. Yeah. Kind of the
exactly.
unknown.
The temporal frontier, and we will talk about it later in our interview about knowledge production and its frontier. And another key word in your book is otherness. So the constant otherization of Hokkaido is another phase of the story of Japanese modernity. So could you please let us know what is the role of Hokkaido in securing of a distinctive Japanese identity in the face of the othering process of modernity?
This is a really tricky question. Yes, Hokkaido is essential to think through modernity in Japan, but I think I'm pushing back against the idea of a distinctive Japanese identity or a distinctive dairy farmer identity for that matter, not just in this book, but in other stuff I've written too. I'm really the product of a kind of a postmodern anthropology of the 1990s and early 2000s, and having lived in Japan for nearly 2 decades now, very little really compels me to think of Japanese identity as uniquely unique or homogenous, or in that other kind of way, Japanese identity and us versus them kind of identity. And there might be a host of reasons for this. For example, my coming to Japan, having lived long term in other Asian countries before, so I lived a year in India, a year in Korea, a year in Thailand. Before coming to Japan, it didn't strike me as particularly unique. My focus on this industry in an area that were kind of on the periphery in Japan, and it wasn't even until I sort of finished my doctoral research that I had any real contact with institutional Japan, like universities, where many of the key tropes like senpai kohai or vertical power relations really are truly central. I think many people come to Japan and are immediately faced with situations that reinforce a particular way of looking at Japan, and I didn't really have that. And I think that dairy practices and products are kind of uncomfortable truth in regard to sort of Nihonjin Ronish or theories of Japanese-ness claims of collective uniqueness. So, borrowing from Mikhail Bakhtin, I see this as a contrast between the epic and the novel, right? The epic as an unchanging and unchangeable story of Japanese identity, which is often rooted in the distant past or cooperative agriculture. And the novel, which are stories based on inimitable characters and their particular interactions in the here and now. So in my case, Hokkaido dairy farmers. My real focus on otherness is actually pushing against that classic idea of stereotypes and the formalization of categories like us and them, working against the othering of groups and attempting an individual recognition of what I call each otherness, or distinct individuals forming assemblages of relations, often with widely different backgrounds, embodiments, aspirations. And I reckon some readers of a folkloric or Japanese studies kind of ilk are going to a little bit buck against this presentation. But I think other people will find it compelling and interesting. I hope so anyway. I think people probably coming from a more social theory or sociological or anthropological take on Japan might find it not such a stretch, but I've had a battle with others.
So I think we have talked a lot about Japan, about modernity, about otherness, but we have not touched the Hokkaido Dairy Farm. So I think it's time for us to talk about the Grand Hope Farm, which is at the center of your ethnography. So could you please let us know what are the controversies surrounding the establishment of this farm, and how does it reflect the local people's quest for security?
Well, I mean, we could go all the way back here to, I mean, the introduction of farming in Hokkaido back in the early Meiji period. But I think the real focus here is on the 1990s, the late 1990s. The Japanese government was really pushing to incorporate these small farms, like the one that I worked on. They bought in 100%, right? In their case, Grant, what I call Grand Hope's Farm, Four families pooled their resources in 2000. They took out these huge loans, purchased new technology like their first rotary dairy parlor system. I don't want to go into too much detail here. The book goes into a lot of detail, but basically this is a piece of technology that can milk 60 to 80 cows simultaneously, a really big change in technology. So these four independent farm families opted to incorporate, becoming what is now called a mega farm. So when they started, they had about 800 cows. As of today, they have about 3,000 cows. But at the same time, smaller farms fought against industrialization, lobbying the JA and the government, and retaining a host of subsidies. And they remain small, say, 100 head or less. They're single family owned and operated and highly subsidized. And still other farmers were caught in between this, expanding but not expanding enough and going out of business, or just opting out and leasing their land, usually to these growing dairy farms. So kind of like my use of frontiers that we discussed before, this idea of searches for security are at the heart of these moves from a macro to micro level, right? You have the national drive for food security that encourages the incorporation and productive efficiency. Then you have the various level of government and co-ops sustaining quotas and offering subsidies, paradoxically countering this drive for efficiency and incorporation in order to essentially gain more rural support for themselves. It's a situation that agricultural economist Aurelio Mulligan has called schizophrenic, right? So you have on the one hand the offering of the drive to try and get farmers to incorporate and expand their farms, while at the same time giving the farms they're competing with subsidies. And then you have the gambling and jockeying of individual farmer owners in terms of their own physical, financial, and ontological security. And this is what I kind of frame as the search for security throughout the book. And it continues on all the way down with relations between farmhands and cows forced into an industrial and not pastoral mode of production. You've heard the expression before, I'm sure, that it's turtles all the way down to describe causation. I guess what I'm saying here is the search for security goes all the way top to bottom in this context, from the national government to the regional co-ops, to the local politicians, to the milk companies, to the farm owner, and to their treatment of cows and workers, and the workers' treatment of cows goes all the way down.
Excellent. I think, yeah, the quest for security is definitely a very useful frame for us to capture this very complex tension or dynamics around this farm. And we will talk about it later about the theoretical potential of this frame. And talking about the farm, work and labor constituted the mainstay of farm life. So what about employment conditions? What is the situation of staff members of the farm, and how do they negotiate their schedules and entitlements and, for their quest for security?
Okay. That's a great question. And we could go on for this on about this in quite a while, and the book does. But the thrust is that there's no average dairy farm or dairy farm owner beyond statistical imagination. What you have is an extremely eclectic range of owners and farms and that potential employees, and again, these employees are desperately needed, they can choose from these different types of farms. So you have farm owners who are eager to expand at any cost and farm owners that are happy with the status quo. Some farm owners are notoriously kind and considerate to their workers. Others are notoriously not. And owners are aware what they can offer potential workers, and they kind of sell their attributes to their particular farm. So you have farms that emphasize freedom, but maybe have low pay and offer seasonal vacations, or farms that have long demanding hours, but better pay. Some offer housing, some offer meal plans, some offer vehicle rental. Some appeal as a kind of family homestay. Others focus on their cutting technology. Believe it or not, I know that one offers Thai massage. I know another one that offers yoga classes. And location as well is a huge selling point, like proximity to a city or a ski hill or an onsen. So, it's kind of like workers. If you line up five farms, you're going to find 50 differences between those farms.
Okay, so yeah, dairy farmers, they are basically, I think, they are internally various and they have significantly internal differences. But in your book, you also mentioned in Japan, they are paradoxically described and treated as an identical internal other.
Yeah.
And in the early stages of fieldwork, you pay a lot of attention to social and group categories of this fairy farmers, but in the later stages, you changed your mind and select a very different approach. So what made you realize that Clear cut social categories and ideal types are problematic for analyzing their reformers.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I change my mind so much as it's a kind of shift. So what I'm doing is, I don't say it in the book, but I've said it since, that the problem with intersectionality is that intersectionality can never really be intersectional enough, right? So the problem with singular reductive identities is obvious enough, I guess, if we say the Japanese, right? Very easy group to essentialize, right? But you have the legal definition of that, right? Who's popularly viewed as Japanese is always a debate, right? You have mixed ethnicity individuals, you have a Korean by birth imperial family, you have Japanese by blood who've lived a lion's share of their time outside of Japan, and so on. So you can squeeze individuals into categories to make particular points. And nearing the end of the book, I sort of start with individuals, and then nearing the end of the book, I do this, right? I frame, for example, as I mentioned, locals, low-siders, outsiders, and no-siders. I talk about gender divisions. I look at how local religious practices can often define insiders and outsiders. But again, my real hope is to look at individuals and their transformations first and foremost, right? Their individuated otherness. And I think if any part of the book really hammers that home, it's probably the epilogue, where you've had, you know, certain characters there, certain interlocutors that you've been introduced to 15 years prior, and then you kind of see where they are now, and you never would have predicted where they are now.
Thank you. I really admire your effort to capture this kind of particularity and against universality in your ethnography, because I think it is definitely really, really difficult. We will talk about it later about this ethical approach. So in chapter 7, you use the phrase the state of liminality to describe the condition of most diary reformers. So what do you mean by this term? And can you offer some concrete examples from the book to elaborate on it?
Yeah, like the frontier, you've chosen another framing here that's gotten me into trouble over the years. But I'm really happy that you bring this up. I'm sure speaking to a fellow anthropologist or other anthropologists, they would know, but in classic liminality theory and anthropology via Van Gennep and Turner, you have a process whereby an individual goes through a socially sanctioned change, right? So the classic example here is a religious ritual or a coming of age ceremony. There are other examples, for example, going into the military. But in the classic coming of age ceremony, initially one is recognized as a youth. There's a ritual process whereby a socially culturally agreed threshold is crossed. And then on the other side of the ritual, the person is viewed as an adult. Now, there are two kind of key points to this transformation here. First, the threshold is agreed upon. It's a socially agreed upon threshold. And second, it needs to be crossed. And I'm claiming that liminality is itself liminal in some regards in these sort of changes of life in and amongst dairy farmers, or certainly dairy farm workers. Again, you need an agreed upon threshold to cross, and you need to get to the other side to see the transformation. And many people remain in a kind of limbo in this sort of work. They come for a year on a set contract planning to go. That year turns into 2 years or 3 years. They're constantly saying they're going to leave soon. Yet that imagined threshold, whatever it might be, the end of the contract, a new job, the start of a new relationship, you know, that threshold never comes to bear. And 10 years later, they're still saying that the transformation is coming, that it's coming. You know, to be honest, I could have really saved myself some trouble and called this life course limbo or something else, because I often get anthropologists saying, you know, looking back to that sort of classic anthropological theory aspect and saying, well, what's the connection between dairy farm workers and tribal life in Africa? And there isn't any, right? I could have used another expression, but I stuck with liminal liminality, and I'm in too far now, so I'm sticking with it.
it's a fascinating phrase, and I really like it. It's, you know, really interesting. Then I think we have already discussed about dairy reformers, and we will turn our focus to their work. And when analyzing farm work and farm life, you use flow as a metaphoric description of work in dairy farming. You describe office work as hard work and parlor work as hard work. How can we appreciate the transient and interactive nature of farm life from the two types of work?
Right, so the whole idea of flow as a metaphoric description, well, there's a theme here with your questions and metaphors. I think I need to be more literal. The whole idea of flow that I use is just a way that I use to imagine the sort of constant paradox of movement and security, those two things working together, right? So milk is a liquid, manure is a liquid, semen is a liquid, antibiotic injections are liquids, and so on. There's the flow of workers in and out of the farm. There are the various systems within the farm that flow. And all of this is rooted in this need to secure, right? The key idea of securing, having a secure source of milk, which is then sold to then keep the cash flow of the farm secure, which is all dependent upon all these elements sort of floating together. So all of this has to function to keep a farm afloat, so to speak. I think I'm rambling. So the three types you were saying, so head work, heart work, and how, okay. So in keeping with your last question, head work is the flow of information, keeping track of cows, workers, payroll, who enters the farm, who leaves the farm. Okay, so office work is head work. Heart work is internal, like a circulatory system. Who regulates the cows in and out of the milking parlor? The proverbial heart of an operation, right? So where does the milk, sewage, semen flow, right? That's the kind of idea.
The other type of work, you describe them as arms and legs of the farm. Compared to office work and parlor work, these works are marked by their externality, where they are equally important to keep the farm functioning. So could you please give us some examples of such work? And could you please explain how do they revolve around others as well as the quest for security?
Great. Okay. Yeah. No, that, yeah, I forgot the extremities, right? The arms and legs. So, well, there are many examples in the book, from local restaurant owners to medical staff to equipment dealers and so on. So they're not part of the farm itself, but they're kind of external to the farm and central in keeping everything flowing. They all have their own relations and their own quests for security. So, for example, equipment dealers use this mega industrial farm as a kind of showroom for what it sold as the future of dairying. So they would bring, there was a relationship between the owner of the farm and the local equipment dealer, and he would bring in farmers who would potentially wanted to buy this equipment. So it functioned as a kind of showroom for them. If there wasn't a steady supply of local farmhands who are usually single, usually busy, and usually very hungry, the local restaurants would suffer and they would suffer. Regional medical services often deal with maladies brought on by agricultural industrialization, be it injuries from equipment to animals, and maybe most interestingly to things like depression, exhaustion, and suicide. These were actually seen as quite large local problems.
Excellent. And as we already mentioned, one of your major research interests is about human-animal technology relationships. And I think one of the most fascinating parts in your book is about your analysis about the rotary parlor milking system in the farm. I really like this part. And I think you have already published an article in the Journal of Critique of Anthropology about this issue. The adoption of the rotary parlor milking system is a change of heart in the dairy industry. So how has the rotary parlor system facilitated interactions with others among human, animals, and technology, and disrupted existing human non-human interactions? It's a long question, but I think you can get me.
Yeah. I mean, I've written about this, like you pointed out, I've written about this in a couple of articles out there, but the Colesnos version would be that the move to rotary parlor systems, again, these are systems capable of milking multiple cows simultaneously, up to 80 cows. I think some of the larger ones now are up to 100 cows, with a nearly unending flow in and out of the system, has been a huge departure from earlier line or herringbone systems, right? Focused on individual cow and individual milking. And I hope your readers aren't falling asleep with this description. Anyway, in short, moving from a kind of one-to-one relationship with cows and embodied in affect-tuned modes of milking and farmer animal care, a sort of one-on-one kind of connection, to a system that I described lifting from Weber as kind of disenchanted, right? Or building a little bit from actor network theory, what I call an animal hyphen cow hyphen machine assemblage, right? Where it's hard to distinguish at the time of milking, certainly for human workers, the cow from the mechanical equipment. And this, alongside the required shift work, breaks down bounds between humans, animals, and humans and cows. And now, kind of somewhat interestingly and unexpectedly, and there might be an article in this in the future, due to COVID and the difficulties bringing in the cheap foreign labor, originally largely from mainland China, and then now more from Southeast Asia, There's been a shift to robotic milking, which I was told 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, was impossible to catch on in Tokachi, but it's now becoming a bit of a boom. But that's a future article, maybe.
Fascinating. I'm very looking forward to reading it. And yeah, I think this kind of human-animal technology relationships is always in flux and always in changing. So I'm very looking forward to your new article. So I think we have to go to the part about knowledge production, because it is also a very important part of your ethnography. You describe form as a microcosm of agentive being and becoming, in which numerous actors have various actions based on their quest for security. With this understanding, you highlight the singularity and plurality of social actors and the necessity of seeing one's internal otherness. I do think it's a very impressive and ethically correct effort, but I can see it's extremely difficult to strike a balance between analytic generalization and an individual singularity. It is difficult because in doing so, we analyzed, we as scholars or as writers, we need to face this kind of chaotic realities, but we also have our own labor to seek the security. So what was the most difficult part for you in using this analytical approach to just suspend your quest for security? And what advice would you give to the researchers following your approach?
Wow, I love this question. Because it's beyond difficult, really, I think. And I'm not sure I would advise people to do this unless they want to spend 18 years fretting over a book and arguing with people at conferences with a variety of gatekeepers and so on. But I imagine this is or maybe even the core tension across the humanities and social sciences, right? You have structure and agency, the social and the self, and so on. So it's nothing new, and I touched on it a few minutes back. But the idea for the book is, I think, a bit more modest. I mean, basically, I'm just taking as a starting point, I think a somewhat uncommon starting point. I'm saying let's not begin with what Latour calls the default social, right? Building out analysis from nationality, ethnicity, gender, region, age, class, socioeconomic status, level of education, these sort of classifications, right? I mean, obviously, these are essential, quite literally essential to what makes us an individual, but all differently coalesce in any one person at any particular time. Now, when you add to this other aspects of daily life that are extremely difficult to quantify, qualify, weigh, or control, or can even be contradictory at times, such as intelligence, personality, how a person is embodied, or just simply luck, for example, these two are essential, in how somebody gets through their day-to-day life. They're what make you and your life inimitable. And ethnographers, perhaps more than other social scientists anyway, need to contend with these day-to-day aspects that are hard to tick off on a questionnaire or in a structured interview, or again, that are shifting and changing over time. So doing long-term fieldwork, at least if you are doing it well, in my view, you're not focused on some extremely, and to me, almost unimaginably structured environment. You start to see the endless fluctuations in any of the aforementioned categories. And added into the mix, you know that certain people are, and I'm not concerned with political correctness here, but some folks who are just, not very bright, they might be outgoing, they might be athletic, but they might be unlucky. Okay, or on the other hand, you have a brilliant person, but he's sly, or he or she is sly or slow moving, or they're always lucky. The point is, if you live in a fast changing environment for a long time, you start to soon see these carefully constructed social categories are extremely malleable, rife with expectations and also exceptional people. So my approach, and I'm kind of pushing back on this because I don't know if it's approach, or at least wasn't an intentional approach, is just to say, okay, we'll get back to social categories in the later chapters. And in the book, I do focus on social categories and nearing the end of the book, but I wanted to start with the individual first for once, right? Even at the level of singular biology, right? Human and cow, for example, I discuss why particular cows on an industrial dairy farm, again with 3,000 cows, why farmed cow number 603 or cow number 1282 in my case seem to like certain workers and dislike other workers, or how certain workers form attachments with certain cows that are just unnoticeable cows for other people. And once you extend this out, I think to human relations, you just see the fact that people don't get on with others and do get on with others, and why is not just a simple matter of social category, right? So statistically, things can be consistent, but individuals are seldom consistent. Moreover, Ian Hacking once wrote something along the lines of, I'm not in the practice of making up people from statistics. You know, you could say that you have 0.6 children on average, but that might mean somebody with 0 children, 1 children, and 4 children. And each of those individuals is living a pretty different reality, even if on paper it can be summed up as 0.6. And I think I'm saying the same thing regarding space and place. Let's look at this particular farm first, this particular town, this particular subregion, this particular prefecture, before seeing how it fits into this sort of myopic notion of Japan or Japanese-ness. But to get back to your question, would I recommend writing, thinking this way to advance your academic career? Probably not. You're going to step on some toes, and those toes are sometimes attached to people with power who are very invested in a certain way of thinking. And that way of thinking may be dated or even absurd. But anyhow, that's my take.
Thank you so much for this amazing answer and for this very kind, advice for new researcher. But yeah, I personally think there is no right or wrong if you choose to categorize or you want to follow the philosophy of becoming. But I do admire your effort to do this kind of work, to flow with your interlocutors, not only in your fieldwork, but also in your analysis. So it's really, really amazing. And I really recommend our audience to, read the second part of this book, the second half of this book to see how you strive to do it. It's just amazing. So as we are approaching to the end of the podcast, I'd like to give my final question. Okay. So, Paul, you spent 2 decades on Hokkaido Dairy Farm. It is a very long and fruitful journey. You bring such a wonderful ethnography to your readers. So after this project, what are you working on now?
Outside of journal articles and teaching, I guess I really have 2 things on the go. I'm working on a book that focuses on similar themes, but it's not limited to dairy farming. And some I'm looking at ikigai, or what makes life meaningful, and One Health as motivating factors for why people might move to Hokkaido. And I, by extension, you could say move to other rural regions, perhaps, kind of working against this idea of rural Hokkaido as being in decline, or at least questioning how to frame decline, which always tends to be rooted in a kind of macroeconomics. And there are a host of issues here, for example, how top-down rural revitalization projects tend to overstate that idea of that prefix re. In your podcast is based in the US, it's kind of a make the rural great again, sort of the MAGA version of rural revitalization, kind of looking backward and not forward. I think the focus should be on vitalization and just forget the re, making rural spaces full of vitality. And sometimes this requires completely imagining a location in ways that wasn't in the past. What made them vital in the past is maybe has now gone, and the idea then becomes how to help people move on from this. And I'm also co-editing a book with my friend and colleague Susanna Klein, which is due out in 2025, tentatively entitled The Rural Handbook of Japan. And there's going to be about 20 or so authors focused on different rural regions, and it's part of a great series of handbooks published by MHM Limited in Japan, and then it's distributed by the University of Amsterdam Press. So in the next 2 years ago, that's basic 2 years to go, that's the plan. And then teaching at Akita University and Akita International University should keep me pretty busy, I think.
They are all amazing projects. And I just have one very quick question about Ikigai, because in Gordon Matthews' set of work about happiness and the concept of self in Japan, he just introduces the concept of Ikigai to wider readership in anthropology. So I think, according to my own understanding, I think Ikigai is about the search for the meaning of life. And in your book, as we have already mentioned in our conversation, the quest for security is a
Yeah.
very important topic. So do you think there is a connection between Ikigai and dairy farmers' search for security? And further, could you do you think this connection could go beyond Hokkaido dairy farm to other fields in today's Japan?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think Ikigai is ultimately related to sort of ideas of ontological security, right? How people have a stable sense of self, or how they see that sense of self extending out into the future. And so how I would relate it, I guess, to dairy farm workers would be you have dairy farm workers who see dairy farming as, and I think this comes out in the center of the middle chapters of the book, but you have certain dairy farm workers who view dairy farm work as their ikigai. It's their, it's almost like a religious calling, right? You have other dairy farm workers who view it as a way, you know, a paycheck. They're basically just doing this to make money to follow their other interests, or maybe just as a kind of experience. And then you have still others who it's a living hell. You know, they can't wait to get out of dairy farming, and they run away as quickly as possible because their ikigai and their sense of ontological security lies somewhere else, obviously. And yeah, I think this extends, this idea of questioning ikigai, extends well beyond dairy farming into any aspect of life. I think it's a really fruitful, and it's hence the reason that I'm looking at it in this new project. I think it's a really fruitful way for anthropologists to kind of think about how people search for meaning in their lives, and how there's a kind of continuity, right? Continuity and change, actually, in any one person's life.
Okay. Thank you for sharing all your thoughts and all your amazing ongoing projects with us. And we were very looking forward to benefiting from your insights in the future. So thank you for coming today, Paul.
Yadong, this was a real pleasure. I really enjoyed this.
It's our pleasure.
Take care.
It's our pleasure.
All right.
Thank you. So
ciao.
In this podcast, I talk with Professor Paul Hansen about his new book titled Hokkaido Dairy Farm, Cosmopolitics of Otherness and Security on the Frontiers of Japan, published by the SUNY Press this year in February. Using a dairy farm as the entry point, this book reveals how the dairy industry in Japan has always been intertwined with notions of otherness and security seeking. If you are interested in rural Japan, the dairy industry, and multi-species interaction, this book will be a helpful read. Thank you for listening to the New Books in Anthropology, and we will see you next time.